Psychosocial Causes of Pain, presented by Clayton W. Bell, Clinical Assistant Professor of Family Medicine at the University of Tennessee Graduate School of Medicine in Knoxville. Dr. Bell spoke at the recent Targeted Pain Treatment Conference, presented by the University of Tennessee Graduate School of Medicine and its Department of Anesthesiology.
First of all, I just want to say thank you very much, Stephanie, for giving me the opportunity to come here and talk to y'all today. It's an honor. It's really cool and exciting to be talking to y'all about these things. Thank you very much. So what I want to do today is let's go a little bit, above. Let's go to the brain. Let's look at the psychosocial factors and the way this actually influences chronic pain. So this is a nice Ayurvedic proverb. It says, yatha pinde, tatha brahmande. What it literally translates to essentially is, as is above, so is below. I want you to be thinking about that throughout this presentation and with your own patients as well. Sometimes the source of the pain, is really obvious, right? And you see this, people come in and, okay, well, obviously you hurt, you just got in a car crash or, you had this major disc herniation, what have you. But in most of the patients that I take care of personally, and I bet a lot of your folks too, the problem is a little bit deeper and it's a little bit below the surface. And so you might be seeing swans on top here, but underneath there's some either a really traumatic experience potentially, or this chronic state of anxiety that really predisposes a person to a chronic pain. And so a really good example, for instance, I take care of a lot of women that have chronic pelvic pain. Okay, does anyone here have any patients they take care of that have chronic pelvic pain? Okay, yeah, it's really challenging, right? In every single client that I've cared for in that capacity, all but one have some history of trauma. And that could be sexual abuse, could be a motor vehicle accident, there could be a surgery where things might have gone awry. So if we don't bring that to light or address that, we can't really get down to some of these underlying issues while they're in protection mode, while things are chronically tight there, while they experience pain, right? And that could be, significantly affecting their lives, right? Whether it's urination or, lack of ability to enjoy sex with their partner. So it's really important we dig a little deeper. So clinical relevance for all this, right? It's obvious when you actually start thinking about it. But, back, say 100 years ago, we thought the pain was really purely just tissue damage for the most part. And then around 50 years ago, 70 years ago, we started thinking, hey, there's actually a lot more to this. And you see that with, say, the placebo effect, right? Or phantom limb pain. Okay, how can the arm hurt if the arm's not even there? That doesn't make any sense at all. There must be something going on in the body. And with placebos, if you want to take it farther, it's really interesting. Shots are even more effective placebos than pills. And the pills can be more effective based on the diagnosis and the color of the pill. So it's really fascinating. So now this is obviously becoming pretty accepted. You're all here. I'm talking about this. So we know this is something that we can intervene on early. And if we do get early intervention, if you get in early on these folks, right after, say, a trauma's occurred, or when this chronic pain first starts, you can make a lot bigger difference than if this is something that's been going on for years and years and years and years. And these neural pathways are more hardwired in, right? So these are some of the psychosocial theories that have developed over time. The top one is more Freudian in nature. It's really the psychoanalysis. The idea was that there was some emotional pain that was manifesting itself physically. And then if you go back to undergrad psychology, you might recognize this by B.F. Skinner. It's more this behaviorist model where this pain behavior is being reinforced. And you might see some of this in your patients, right? You have these folks that are chronically in pain, but by being so, they're getting, say, sympathy from their family members. They're coming into the physician's office or the hospital. They're getting attention. So sometimes we do unwillingly kind of perpetuate this process in our best efforts to help. Cognitive theory talks about these intervening variables are going to have a big influence on this. And it's like, say, things like cognitive behavioral therapy come in. It can be so effective for these folks, but it's their expectations, their beliefs, their sense of personal control. This is huge. Okay. A lot of folks, they feel hopeless. They don't feel like they have any control. They've literally farmed out their health to the doctor. How many folks come to you and ask you to fix them, essentially? Have you ever experienced that? first of all, it's a lot of pressure on us, right? And it's not really fair. But, you know, secondarily, that's not our responsibility, and that's not even in our capacity to do that. So if we're able to empower that patient in some capacity to help heal themselves, or at least be a partner in the process, that's huge for their potential to actually heal. And then these psychophysiological approaches. And so these are really these mental events. You know, it could be memories, traumas, perceptions, emotions, and the impact this has on the autonomic nervous system, right? And how that can modulate this experience of pain. And is everybody pretty familiar with autonomic nervous system, right? Got two branches. Got our sympathetic. Got our parasympathetic. The parasympathetic is going to be that nice rest and digest, relaxation, meditation, hanging out with the family, hanging out in nature, playing with your pets, sleeping, okay? And then your sympathetic nervous system is going to be obviously much more that fight or flight response, or freeze for that matter, right? And what happens so often, especially in our society today, is we are literally trapped in this fight or flight response, nonstop, nonstop, nonstop. I know you see this in your patients, right? The folks that come in and they're just so anxious and they can't come down. They're just up here all the time. But I bet even more so perceptually, what I like to do is I like you to actually think about this on an experiential level in yourself. How many times do you come home from practice at the end of the day? Are your muscles tighter? I carry it in the back of my leg. Do you feel like you're constantly running from one thing to the next? I got this patient, I got this note, I got that email, I got that project. Hey, I actually want to do a little research too on the side, right? How to divvy all that out. And that's just your work responsibility. That doesn't even include if you're actually a husband or a wife, a mother, a child, a father, son or daughter, a friend. So we have these time constraints, but we have these things that constantly keep us connected. And so that can be our cell phones, our computers, emails. I mean, who checks work emails in the evening or at home or even on vacation sometimes? Who else is guilty of that? Right? We're always plugged in. Very, very rarely do our brains and our bodies, for that matter, ever get a chance to actually come down and discharge. Who lies awake in bed at night before you go to sleep thinking about your patients? Yeah. Now imagine, and hopefully you're not in a chronic pain state, okay? But now imagine your patient doing that, but instead of thinking about their patients, they're thinking about their pain that they're experiencing all the time. And pain so often can be the loudest voice. So you might have a lot of great things going on in your life, but you're not really paying attention to that because this hurts. And the more you think about it hurting, the more it perpetuates that process. So this is that stress sympathetic loop right here. So it's almost like the reptilian brain, the amygdala, the limbic system, we just get looped. And what happens, we get stressed, we hurt, our muscles contract, we get tight, you get more inflammation in the body, perpetuates it, you hurt more, it goes on and on and on and on. Okay, and you get in this downward spiral. How many times have you all seen folks that come to your clinic that are in that downward spiral, right? Yeah, it happens very, very, very often. So anything that you can do to help break that spiral is going to be huge for your patients, okay? And honestly, on a personal level, huge for ourselves. Because as a community, we're stuck in the stress loop as much, if not more, than any other profession on the planet, okay? And it's only going to get worse as we get more and more technology and get more and more plugged in, okay? So we have to be able to support each other and support ourselves for sustainability. I know we can handle different amounts. So as physicians, advanced practitioners, we probably have a pretty high allostatic load threshold. And that can be based on different things. Could be your coping style, your personality type. I mean, how many people in here would consider themselves type A personalities? I bet it's actually a lot higher than that. I bet everyone is. Or you wouldn't be here. Right? You would have chosen a job that was easier, that was less of a challenge, right? But you're either proving something to yourself or something to someone else, right? Or you want to change the world and make a difference. So that's why you're here, right? So you by default are a type A personality. So you by default are one of those kind of people that might get stuck in the stress loop, okay? It's not good or bad, it just is what it is, so just be aware of it. Be aware of the neurology, okay? Social support is huge. Think about one or two patients you have that have debilitating chronic pain, and you've tried everything for medicines, could be injections, could be therapy, could be PT, and they just don't seem to get better. I mean, does everybody have at least one of those people in your mind? Okay, now think about their level of social support. If you never discuss this with them, please, I implore you to do so. But most time, do you find that they're extremely lonely and they have lots and lots and lots of time to basically ruminate and live in their head? And what do they focus on? Their pain, right? Their situation. So stress. So stress and this autonomic nervous system overdrive has a huge impact on our perception of pain. And it's really manifests itself in, you know, if you look at different studies, like 90% of primary care visit appointments. You know, and I hear 180,000 people died in UK every year of diseases that are related to stress. It's a major contributing factor to our 6 causes of death in the U.S., cancer, coronary artery disease, you know, accidental injuries, respiratory disorders, cirrhosis, and even suicide. And, you know, you think about it, when's the most common time to have a heart attack? Anybody know? Yeah, it's early morning, right? It's like about, you know, 5, 6 a.m. on a Monday morning, right? People are going back to work. They get a big cortisol spike. Get a little, you know, vasoconstriction of the coronary arteries, right? They got a little plaque in there. Something's got to give. And, you know, and then obviously things like, you know, industrial accidents, people are chronically stressed out, sleep deprived, what have you. Job STM. Here's that sensory overload I talked about, right? And if you want to think about this on an extreme level, think about autism. Those kids are in sensory overload nonstop, okay? And you see the way it looks, and it hurts you to see them in that much pain, right? I can't imagine being trapped in that body, experiencing that. But our chronic pain patients, they're trapped there too, in a little bit of a different capacity, right? But it's almost feels like this. And at some point, whether it was medical school or residency, did y'all not feel like this? I know I did. I remember going home several times, like just crying. I was broken. I was just emotionally broken, you know, and just wanting to quit. I was so overwhelmed, you know, and luckily I had a great partner that was like, you know, it's going to be fine. Get a good night's sleep, go exercise. You'll be better tomorrow, you know, and got through it and stronger and better because of it. But I mean, sometimes these folks don't have partners with them to help encourage them through it. Sometimes they're just stuck. So these are effects of stress. But you're going to get a huge catecholamine spike. It's going to be the epinephrine, norepinephrine, cortisol. That's going to suppress your T cells, your natural killer cells, your immune system. About half the folks I take care of have cancer. And I might see people that eat a relatively healthy diet. They exercise. They're only 40. Why should you have breast cancer at 40? You don't have any genetics. They're under a tremendous amount of stress. Tremendous. So it's always something you got to look for. As well as predisposed things like diabetes. Obviously, we know about, you know, asthmatics, ulcers. That's kind of a classical thing, right? Stress and ulcers. You know, has anyone here ever had, you know, acid reflux or ulcer? You know, it's probably from our stress. A lot of it, you know, as well as obviously psychiatric illnesses. And when we talk about, you know, in cancer too, metastases too as well. You know, so not only does someone have cancer, but if they're really stressed out and they're immune suppressed, then they're probably going to be way more likely to have mets as well. So just kind of deconstructing this. What basically happens, you have this sensory input, okay? You think about a patient with fibromyalgia, that shouldn't hurt, but it does. So they're basically stuck in this perceptual loop of that sensory sensation causes this pain, right? And unless we interrupt that and basically re-educate their neurological system, that's going to continue over and over and over and over again. And so at the end of the day, so much of that perception is going to manifest itself as experience. So it's almost like you have a palette, right? Okay, and these are your paints. And this is your reality of the world around you. And the paints that you have here are going to dictate what that painting looks like. So it's like a filter. Everything has to come through here to be experienced. So if you can have a paradigm shift with your patients, you can help alter their actual reality. Case in point. You're here. So you can either be like, I'm so excited to learn all these strategies about my pain patients and I'm going to make a world of difference in their life. Or you can be here and say, dang, I had to come here and I've got 20 emails and I got notes to finish up from yesterday, and it's rainy, what have you, right? And your experience here is going to be totally different. We're going to be giving the same presentations, the same folks are going to be here, but when you walk out of here today, the way you feel about it, night and day difference. Once again, I'm not saying anything is right or wrong. I'm just saying it's interesting how these things play into our lives. This is pretty interesting too. Does pain expected, right, influence pain experienced? So do we manifest our own destinies? Yeah. There's a nice little Aristotle quote. Learning is not child's play. We cannot learn without pain. You know, so this is talking about some of those childhood experiences, right? So you have biological factors, you have these developmental factors and these cognitive behavioral factors, and all these things dictate a child's experience of pain. And then things that come along in life, right, are going to add to that. That child's going to become an adult, i.e. us, right? So a lot of what we experience now goes back to childhood. So if you look at these ACE scores, you find that people, and everybody's familiar with the ACE, right? Adverse childhood events. You know, it predisposes everything from, say, diabetes to cancer to heart attacks. And here we find that also anxiety, depression, and fear of pain. I mean, how often do we ask our patients about traumatic events that might have occurred in their life when they're young? You know, I'm starting to more and more and more. So where I come in with a lot of my consultations is to really help patients uncover a lot of these things below the surface. So for me, I go with Dr. Osler here and say it's actually a lot more important to know what sort of patient has a disease than what sort of disease a patient has. So they might have chronic pain, and doing, say, injections and procedures like that is outside my scope. That's above my pay grade, okay? But what I can do is I can help them on a physical, psychological, spiritual level to discover and walk through that process. So I focus on the person, and I think if you do that, it can make a huge difference, right? And there's so many things, there's so many medicines that we use to try to, like, block or shunt or increase or decrease these different ascending and descending pathways that we talked about earlier, right? But there's a lot that you can do with the paradigm shift. If you can help them accelerate or expand their actual consciousness, that is a huge inherent healing mechanism. And we have an entire internal pharmacy inside our bodies, whether it's opiates, whether it is the endocannabinoid system, right? So we can help people tap into that. Inflammatory and anti-inflammatory cytokines. So fear of pain. How many people get nervous before you say you do a presentation? Well, usually that fear is actually probably worse than actually doing the presentation itself, right? Or you might have anxiety before you go in to see a certain patient, like, oh my God, this person, you know what I mean? Like, you think you know how that's going to go, right? Okay, and usually once you get in there, it's not so bad, okay? But our fear of things a lot of times is worse. And so it's the same with these people. They're scared of doing anything because they don't want to hurt. And that just perpetuates the cycle over and over and over and over again. And that can be absolutely debilitating, obviously. So I obviously like Greek philosophy. This is Plato. It says, the cure of many diseases is unknown to physicians because we're ignorant of the whole. For the part can never be well unless the whole is well. So if someone has like a disc herniation, do we address that? Absolutely. Yeah, it would be crazy not to address the actual physiological underlying issue, right? But if we don't address everything else, then we're going to be missing major components that would help in that healing process, right? So I like this term. Instead of focusing on the disease, I like the idea of salutogenesis, where you're actually focusing on wellness. You are really helping that person to develop their problem solving and their capacity. And it's really kind of an interdisciplinary approach, takes everybody, right? But it focuses on someone's resources and capacity to generate health as opposed to purely focusing on, well, you have chronic pain. And it's really, it's more than just a person and interaction with you. It's really the interaction between them and their environment and their society at large. That's where I feel like our job is to come in. You know, we might not be able to just take their pain away, but what we can do is really get down to the core of what being a doctor is. And it's from the Latin word dicere, dicere. And it's from Cicero's De Orator. But essentially what it is it's to teach. It's to teach someone how to live well, right? And I think that's really important for self-care for us too. Because if we are chronically stressed out, it's going to be really hard for us to help our patients come out of that. I met a physician one time and gave me a really good analogy. He said, you know, you can't give what you don't have. And so I think it's so important for us to seek balance in our lives to try to help out with our patients too. You know, and these are really the foundations of health, okay? And if these things are out of whack, and I've already talked about stress at great length, then it's going to be really hard for that person to engage and help themselves in the healing process. But equally important things like, you know, sleep, diet, and exercise. I'll just touch on those real quickly. So parasympathetic activation. Someone throw out your favorite form of parasympathetic activation.
Sleep.
Perfect. Okay. Does anybody in here exercise? Anyone like being in nature? Does anybody meditate? Okay. Does anybody like spending time with family? Does anybody have pets? Okay, cool. So you kind of see, right? You got to get these folks doing more of this. More of this they do, the less they're going to hurt. Even if the stimuli is the same, they're going to hurt less. Exercise is huge. Obviously, if we have chronic pain, we might be inhibited from doing some physical activities, but there is some form of physical activity that every single person can do, okay? And you just got to find that for them and really encourage them to do that. I mean, if you could put this in a drug, we'd all be billionaires if you could patent this. And if you look at the studies too, physical activity is way more effective than SSRIs and everything like that for depression. And the nice thing is they don't take 2 or 3 weeks to kick in. They work immediately. You go for a walk, you go for a run. I got really stressed out yesterday. My last patient had like 20 diagnoses. And it just kept coming, you know, the fibro and this and that and everything else. And it's tough, right? Like you start to internalize some of that energy, or you know, or try not to. And after I left, I got to go for a run. So I went for a few mile run, felt immediately better, right? That's way better than if I would have, you know, say drug myself, you know, but a lot of times that's what we've done with our patients, right? We've got them on all these drugs. They need to be on them. Maybe, you know, but can they take care of themselves in a capacity? Yeah, absolutely. Right. Can they help us out or make the pharmaceuticals more effective? Sure. Anti-inflammatory food pyramid. I see this a ton. And, you know, we're talking about the disc earlier, you know, being say 60%, you know, or 90% even for the nucleus being water. I see folks, they don't drink water, literally. Like, they don't drink water. They drink diuretics, things like sodas and lots of coffee. And, you know, I try to say, hey, you know, let's say 60% of your body is water, you know, like say the nucleus of the disc, right, is like 90% water. You're not a flowing fountain anymore. Your body has become a mud puddle. I have a fountain in my office, so that's a really effective, you know, analogy. And people get that. You know, even more so, right? It's like, would you run your engine without any oil on it? Well, no. Then how are you not going to drink water? You know, when you know that the majority of your body is comprised of water. And I've seen people's pain get better just from that. It's crazy. You know, but ask every single person, how much water do you drink? You know, and if they weigh 200 pounds, try to get them to drink 100 ounces a day. You know, but it's really common. They drink less than a glass of water a day. It's wild. And then a lot of people eat super inflammatory style diets. Now, I'm not saying that any of those foods are good or bad, but a cheeseburger and french fries and a Coke from the local fast food restaurant is not going to help with your chronic inflammation, okay? It's going to increase all those cytokines. And they've shown that a sugary food, like let's say a cupcake, increases CRP in the body for at least 2 to 3 hours, you know, and that's a max. So I talk about that with my cancer patients too. You know, it's like, do you really want increased inflammation in your body? You know, no, you don't. So if you can get someone to focus on things like vegetables, some fruit, you know, beans and legumes, whole grains. I put pasta alternatives on here like black beans, that kind of thing. But, you know, maybe some fatty fish, you know, some healthy fats are really great, you know, some soy foods, and really try to minimize, especially any kind of like processed meats and like really cheap vegetable oils and those kind of things, sweets, too much alcohol. But that will help with their inflammation a ton as well. It's really impressive. Sleep. As I was preparing this, I just read across a study a couple of days ago, actually, and they found that when they would intentionally sleep deprive patients, their perception of pain increased 15 to 30%. So you think about your chronic pain patients, okay? If you think more than 50% of them are sleep deprived, raise your hand. Yeah, they are. A lot of times they sleep 4 or 5 hours a night. And also, it's not just sleep. Their circadian rhythm is totally off, okay? You know, they should have a melatonin spike when the sun goes down and be getting ready for bed, but instead they're watching TV. They're watching the news at 11 o'clock at night. How are you supposed to come down neurologically after watching the news at 11 o'clock at night? You know, and all you hear about is everything is catastrophizing the entire world. And I don't care what your political affiliation is. It's stressful, you know. And so it's like, no, please don't watch the news. If you're going to watch it in the morning or watch it in the mid-afternoon. Do not watch it before you try to go to sleep and quiet your mind. You know, and then people will sleep until 10 or 11 o'clock and then are tired all day. Well, your cortisol is all supposed to spike between like 6 and 8 in the morning, okay? And that's going to get you up and keep you up throughout the day, right? And drop down throughout the day. But we do like adrenal stress index tests on these people, and their cortisol levels are jacked. You know, they might be flatlined at the day, then have a big spike right before they go to bed at night. So you're trying to like bring them back in line from an endocrine standpoint too. You know, it's really incredible. So if you can just get someone following the natural rhythms of life, like you wake up with the sun, you go to bed with the moon, it's huge. And so all these things play into epigenetics. So who in here is familiar with epigenetics? Awesome. Yeah, so this is going to be like, you know, a huge, huge, huge branch. You know, the future of medicine as we learn more and more about this, because we can't change our genes, right? Your genes are the alphabet that's set. But the words that you use to make the sentences and a paragraph and the story of your life are set through your epigenetics. And the cool thing about that is we can determine that. It's every single meal we eat. It's what you ate for breakfast this morning. It was how you slept last night. It's the quality of your relationships. It's actually even your thoughts and how they manifest into different things. Everything that you do is going to either roll up or unroll these different histones and these different DNA expressions. So it's really, really exciting. And this is just huge, powerful, you know, for patients. Like I said, I see a ton of cancer patients, and almost everyone I see thinks that they were predisposed to develop cancer because of their genetics. And that's not the case. Now, there's a few things, obviously, like a Ewing sarcoma or someone's got a BRCA mutation. Yeah, they're going to be way more likely to get it. But even with breast cancer, very few women that actually have breast cancer have BRCA mutations. You know, environment plays way bigger role. Same way with, like, you know, people that have heart attacks. When I was a resident, I'd go to the ED, someone would come up with a heart attack. Well, my dad had a heart attack, and he's got diabetes, so I get diabetes too. And that's BS. That is not true. Now, you might have a genetic predisposition. It's probably your social environment that influenced that way more. It's what you were raised eating. Now, you can look at, for instance, spouses. If your spouse is obese, you are way more likely to be obese than if your parents were. Okay? It's your environment. So we can use this to help modulate people's perception of their life and pain. So clinical pearls, I would say, is in addition to finding the underlying cause, let's focus on the person, okay, not just the pain. Everyone's perception is going to be different, right? It's going to be influenced by a thousand bajillion things, right? It's their perception of life. And then anything you can do to encourage them to engage in their parasympathetic nervous system is going to be extremely healing. The last thing I'll say is this, and this really changed my practice significantly. And I don't know if you would refer to this at the Big Four conference last year too, and it's really powerful. But it really distinguishes between helping, fixing, and serving. So now every time I go in to see a patient, I literally will say like a little prayer, you know, and said, hey, you know, Mary Sue, I'm sorry I can't fix you. You know, please forgive me for my inadequacies as a healer, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to serve you. And then when I go in there, it takes all the pressure off me, because it is so hard to see someone hurting so badly and you want to make them feel better so much, but you can't. And if you see multiple people like that a day, especially in a row, it weighs on us heavily. And I don't know about y'all, but I want to be doing this for a long time. So I want it to be sustainable. And I take care of healthcare providers often at our hospital. And I see what chronic stress does, okay? So if I can serve them instead of trying to fix or help them, I think that sets me up for success. And I would encourage you to do the same thing. If I can ever be of service to you or your patients in any capacity, please let me know. And thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Bell. For information about upcoming CME activities from the University of Tennessee Graduate School of Medicine, visit gsm.utmck.edu/CME. And for information about upcoming CME meetings we're recording around the country, visit our website, audiodigest.org, and click on the Inside Audio Digest tab at the top of the page on your dashboard.